Joining me in the Catalyst studio today are Eric Higgs and George Gordon with LumaStream. Welcome, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning, Joe.
So we have a series going on the Catalyst called Origin Stories, and we're here today to learn about, from the very, very beginning, how LumaStream came to be the company that is today. And I think that starts with you, Eric, and an installation you had in Tampa.
Yes, thanks, Joe. Appreciate your interest in our company. My background has been disruptive technology companies, much like George's, my whole career, but I've also pursued a very serious professional sculpture career. And when I moved from San Francisco in 2002, I was pursuing the sculpture full time. To fast forward, my last project before the banking crisis hit was a six-story garage that covered a city block, the Element Building in Tampa. And I won the commission to do something interesting on the side of that garage, which was 120 10 by 5 foot sculptural panels, and I needed to light it. I've always been fascinated with light as it creates the mood, it creates the drama, especially as the evening comes in and the light brings focus to certain items and art in particular. That light has a tremendous impact and is necessary. So as I looked into it, I've been more or less an environmentalist my entire life, since a small kid, actually. And I was looking at the energy consumption of what would typically be used in metal halide lights. And I calculated it was about 22,000 watts of power required to run this. And at night, the lights would run 10 to 12 hours a day. LEDs were just coming online, and I was fascinated with the technology. It was based on quantum physics, not running power through a filament in a vacuum, the same technology that, you know, Edison
been around a while.
Had 130 years ago. So I started looking at the efficiencies and the fact that because it can be digitally controlled, all the things you can do with it. So I found a gentleman in Tampa that was messing around with building LED fixtures in his garage. I teamed up with him, with Chris Booth, who also worked with me in my art studio, and we built our own fixtures. And it became very apparent that the way the industry was approaching it was flawed, that putting what's a low voltage product, DC power, on a high voltage AC infrastructure made absolutely no sense. Very much, it should be treated like a stereo amplifier and speakers. So that was the advent of LumaStream, is to build a logical system from ground up that maximizes the benefits of LEDs. On that art project installation, for instance, instead of 22,000 watts, it turned out to be 880 watts. To power the entire city block, lighting up the sculptural panels, just absolutely profound. So the realization, again, was that there's a high-tech product now coming into an extremely low-tech industry. And because the big companies don't typically innovate, there's too much inertia, it's the small ones that take a chance and do that. So what happened in 2009, roughly, is that I studied the lighting space for about a year before I pulled the trigger. It's not the easiest time to start a company in a banking crisis, but fortunately, I had a number of friends and family members and business contacts. A lot of them I helped make money for in the past that backed me. And we were able to get this thing going. We were able to pull together the technology by an engineer that had actually had a good jumpstart on it out of Canada. And our approach was to sell an entire LED lighting system on a power infrastructure that made sense, that solved literally all the problems, the premature failure, the flicker, the color problems over time. I'm talking about white light as well. And we created this system. We have 22 patents, 9 pending, and many more to come after that. So when nobody else was looking at this space, we were. So we have an 8-year track record of, without a doubt, by multiple times over, the most robust, longest lasting LED lighting system in the world.
So was it your and Chris's lights that were used in that installation in the end?
Yes.
So you actually built those?
We built those from scratch.
Them in the installation?
We used them in the installation.
That's great. And you said that as you were taking that year to understand the industry and form your plan forward, that you got a first round of support from some people.
Basically, friends and family, my own money. So $1.5 million in seed capital.
And you said you had made money for some of them in the past. Can you elaborate a little bit on what some of the other
Worked in the Silicon Valley. I started learning mobile computing, learning software company back when mobile computing wasn't even a word back in 94. That had an evolution where our investors made some money. I helped start, not as a founder, but one of the founding executives of City Search. And we built that, which ended up being a merger with Ticketmaster and a market cap over $1 billion. And then I've worked as an advisor board member in other companies that have made money for investors. And the common theme is just perseverance. I mean, it's brutal building a tech company. I know you've seen that with some of the local companies. That's a common story.
Sure.
So especially when you're disrupting an industry, it's not worth going through all this if it's not a revolutionary product. It's got to be significantly better. If you're doing something that's incrementally improving, you're going to get run over. It's not enough. So that is what we aim to do. Over the history of the company, we've raised about $26 million. We are raising funds now that will position us as a very valuable potential acquisition target. We received incredible validation last week, the biggest AV trade show in the nation, Audiovisual Integrators, who are going through. I'll explain that in a minute, but it's the biggest trade show in North America. We won Best Product. And now we have some very, very large companies approaching us for partnerships. It's going to get real interesting, but it's everything we've been working toward all these years. So we're at this great inflection point where all this work is looking like it's going to pay off big time.
That's great. And I want to continue to close the gap between that and the beginning. So obviously at $1.5 million for a, you know, locally here is a decent seed round, friends and family round, bigger than a lot of people's A rounds here. But you're coming into this with an experience in doing this. So it wasn't just, hey, I'm going to start a company for the first time. You had some gravitas behind this raise and some track record and rails that you were running on.
Well, I had either led or been one of the primary people in raising about $120 million for tech startups in my career, mostly in the Silicon Valley. When I moved here and when I started, switched from sculpture to high tech, I really didn't have the contacts here. This is all money out of the area, the 1.5. The rest of it, about two-thirds of it, came from the Tampa Bay area. It's been very laborious. There really isn't organized private equity or VC funding that is targeted and toward the kind of valuations you get determined by other things than a multiple of trailing revenue or EBITDA. I mean, high-tech companies start up that you don't have an EBITDA and you really don't want it because you can't move and grow fast enough. Now, later on, like where we are now, we're working very quickly toward a positive EBITDA and cash flow positive. It's very important at this point. But I think you find a common theme amongst all tech startups here that the professional organized private equity and VC money will come with some big exits and some attention. However, there are lots of sophisticated individuals that have put in significant amounts of money in our company multiple times. The average person has invested at least twice. We have some people invested 6, 7, 8 times now. It's pretty incredible as we move through the history of the company.
Yeah, and I think LumaStream has been a trailblazer in sort of breaking down, transitioning people. We had a lot of real estate money here, right? That's what people were used to investing
hospitality.
In. Hospitality. Hospitality, yeah. So you, SavvyCard, Priatech, you sort of were the 3 or 4 companies that really got people thinking that there are other things that people should invest in. And I think the companies that are starting today benefit from the groundwork that you guys have laid in the last 5 years.
Well, I appreciate that. That's absolutely the truth. So it was as much of an education of risk and reward in a company like this as it was anything else. And the concept of taking a very, you know, a small, under 5% or whatever your risk profile, depending on what stage in life you are, and going for emerging technologies. And we're seeing that some of these large blue chip companies aren't that safe after all,
right?
Because of incredible disruption in so many industries at the same time. You know, who would have thought that the biggest transportation company wouldn't own any hard assets? Uber, no planes, trains, automobiles. It's Uber, the largest accommodations firm in the world, owns no properties, Airbnb. So these disruptions are going to fundamentally undermine the large companies through disruption. And if investors don't place some bets in these types of things, you know, you've got cryptocurrencies and blockchain, neural networks, AI, all these things that are going to be the future, then I think it's a poor balanced investment portfolio, right?
The diversified portfolio must include that now.
Absolutely.
So now we're past this first stage. Who's the team at this point? Who are the core few people that are involved going out of this first round?
We have had the same core team through the history of the company, which I think speaks to the culture and the loyalty of what we're doing and the belief that we really do have an opportunity to change the entire lighting industry. So Michael Gatos is an architect, but he has headed up market development and the launch into our distribution channel, which is our low voltage DC product, like a stereo amp and speakers, into the audiovisual industry. They've never had the chance to sell lighting before. They've been doing control systems for many years. So we launched into that. Mike led the charge there. Tom Richards is Chief Business Development Officer. He's been there almost since the beginning, leading a company, like I said, that we ended up acquiring, had a jump start on the platform that we envisioned. We've had a number of other folks. I mean, George Gordon, who's sitting here, who is now the CEO and president of the company. He was an early investor and has followed an advisor. You might want to say a couple of things about your perspective on the company itself.
Well, thanks, Eric. I first met Eric in 2005 when he was making his living as the sculptor, probably before you did the Elements building. And I met him because my wife is a sculptor. We had that in common. And it was sort of a serendipitous meeting through that relationship that I got reacquainted with Eric in 2011. And he told me about the technology, which I did some research on, and I believe in. I believe it's the future of lighting. I did then. I still do. And invested, I guess, late 2011, early 2012, then a second time after that. And have been close to Eric as a friend and a colleague ever since. And it's now time for the company to begin to scale, and volunteered to come back and take over as the CEO so Eric can continue to work on strategic partnerships and ultimately the exit of the company.
So let's catch back up then. You had the first round. Then how long was it between the friends and family round before you raised your first non-friends and family money?
I wanted to mention a couple other people that have been here. They're local and they deserve a lot of credit. Jack Weiser, that comes from the development community and the finance community, joined us. He saw the vision of what we could do in buildings. He's a Tampa native. Frank Ryder, who is in charge of some of the operational aspects of our company. These are people that have been here since the very beginning. Again, we've been through some very difficult times, but we've pulled out of it. Perseverance is what it takes. And we have investors who have stuck by us and believed in us through those periods and supported us. There's some great people here that have a lot of passion and not only the success of the whole startup community here, but you know, our companies, you mentioned Prioritech Savvy Card being some of the leaders here. There's been some tremendous support for us. Without that, we wouldn't be here today. We have some new team members recently that are critical. We have Ryan Jordan has come in with his experience in sales recently. As George said, we're scaling up into a much bigger company, the plans that we have. And Ashby Green, a lot of people know Ashby from around here. He's our CFO now, and has brought a level of professionalism that we've been seriously lacking on the finance side. So we're putting all the block and tackle and fundamental pieces in, bringing George in as a highly experienced tech entrepreneur, many, many successful exits. And I think we absolutely have the A team now. So we're going to do this. There's going to be big news coming out very soon. In terms of the capitalization of the company, it's been a series of convertible notes and preferred equity rounds, augmented with some debt. The reason for convertible notes is, first of all, it's an easy thing to paper. Second, you typically do a convertible note when it's very difficult to determine a valuation of the company. And so you have a convertible note with some incentives, some discount incentives, and typically with a cap so that the investors that put money in that allow you to grow the company into a more valuable company are protected from some runaway valuation. So that's been very successful. And then we've had a series of equity rounds. Again, $26 million to date. We're raising five more now. We're feeling like this round is the most incredible opportunity of all, especially since last week and these monster players, industry players that are knocking our door down right now.
Was the first round after the seed round, was that a convertible note or was that an equity round? Do you remember?
The seed round was a convertible note.
Oh, seed round was, okay.
And because of some early traction we had, instead of having a convert, mandatory conversion on a formal preferred equity round, I went to the investors and said, I recommend you convert now at a reasonable valuation because you took very early risk. And then we did that and had a Series A closing without new money very quickly to protect those folks that backed me in terms of a valuation before it went way up. So that valuation at that time at the conversion was roughly $6 million. And then we went to $18 million. And it's tiered up from there. So we have a $46 million valuation now on this raise.
So that's pre-money against the five?
Yes, right. So it'll be 51.
Great. And as you progressed through the rounds, you said the team stayed mostly the same?
Yes, we brought a number of people that are not here with us now. I mean, every company maybe misses on some hires, but also there are individuals that are ideal for certain stages of the company. And when the company reaches the next stage, you try to move around different seats of the bus, but that doesn't always work out. So that is really part of the natural evolution of the company. But those core people that have helped build this company, the cornerstones in this company, fortunately have been able to grow and be more relevant as time goes on. And these are wonderful people. I believe the good guys can win, ladies and men. You can build a company with ethics. You can build a company where people are treated with respect. And it all comes down to the leadership. Leaders need to lead, not push. And push people blindly and have expectations. And people are very stressed out under the circumstances. So George and I take an approach of leaders. We'll do anything. We'll clean the toilets if we have to show that we're not above anything else in the company, and then lead them with a vision and give them the resources they need to succeed.
That's great. So George, let's talk about coming from the other side of it as an investor originally and watching the company grow. What are some of the customer wins that you remember? I know you've had a few big names that have come in as customers before you switched to the distribution model, which kind of abstracted that out a layer. But who in your memory were the glorious first wins that when you
saw? The two biggest ones that I remember are PDQs and then Tesla, which currently is struggling with some of its own issues. But we won the contract to do all of their showrooms worldwide.
That's fantastic.
So that was a big win for us.
And if I remember correctly, one of the PDQ things, there was a inside versus outside solution. Were you able to provide the lights for the outside and the inside for the PDQs?
Well, yes. This is Bob Bashams. He's a co-founder of Outback, as most people know. They're located in Tampa under MVP Holdings. Bob gave us a real chance. It was early on. We had a vision and he believed in us. And I think we've done about 75 PDQs across the country now, and we're still providing that lighting for that chain and many others. So that was a validating event because we could go to other customers, especially restaurants, and say, well, the founder of Outback believes in us and we're doing all his restaurants, and that helped us get others. Startups need validating customers, and because it sends a signal to the market. And I felt that if we could grab the golden ring and get what most people consider the most innovative tech company in the world, Tesla, then nobody would question our technology again. And so that happened and allowed us to launch into a very scalable distribution
model. How did that happen? How did you get in the door with that?
I called Tesla, cold called him about 60 times.
Oh, wow.
Until the head of global purchasing
said— back to your word, perseverance.
Yeah, it's perseverance. He finally called me and said, what do I— he used a couple words I won't use on the air, but he said, what do I have to do to stop you from calling me? And how did you get my cell phone? So I said, I need 20 minutes with the design team, the store rollout team, you, and I named a few others. And he said, well, you leave me alone if I give you that meeting. And I said, well, probably. So I flew out there. In 15 minutes, he cut me off. He goes, I get it. It makes total sense. Can you actually provide the power behind and the fixtures we need and the specs that we need to meet? Because they run all kinds of lighting problems in their showrooms. And the cars are Elon Musk's jewelry, right? Need to be lit up right. So the cars look the same in the showroom as they do outside. So we proved that to them by basically building an entire lighting system that blew away what they had, not only met their specs, but exceeded it by a long shot. I told Tesla that we could come in two nights, no interruption of business, put our entire lighting system in. If he liked it, they got to pay for it. If they didn't, we'd rip it out and put their old stuff in. And they loved it. But we still had to go through about a year process to prove ourselves in multiple pilot locations. And then they pulled the trigger on it. So again, that was a very tough sale, but we're incredibly grateful that we have that because it was the ultimate validation. And I think every tech company absolutely needs that to go to the next level.
So at that point, you were selling directly to the businesses. And then at some point, you made the decision to move to working through distributors. Can you talk about that process and how you came to that decision?
Distributors isn't quite the right word for it. The original business plan was to sell through low voltage integrators, which are the AV people, the security cameras and whatnot. They don't need an electrical contracting license to put our product in. And again, they've been putting lighting control systems in for decades, but they've never been able to sell the lighting, even the industry solution to lighting, because you still need to put a high voltage infrastructure in, not the case with us. So we couldn't launch that until we had the validation. We had a broad product set. We had enough marketing materials, the proper website, and the proper support. And it was a rep company that represents brands into these AV integration companies that was knocking our door down out of Texas. It was actually Fred Dobbs of Dobbs Stanford. He's the one that founded the AV rep industry. It's a pretty amazing story. So we started selling directly to AV integrators because their motivation to expand their product categories is enormous. Their margins on, you know, TV, video, stereo equipment has been declining over the years. People are buying them online, and you could buy a 60-inch television, high-def television for $400 now. So they weren't making money on some of those things that were the cornerstone products. So we come along and say, you could expand your revenue dramatically and also get the control work, which you've always been doing. And the interest has been tremendous. So what we're working on now is bridging the, we call it the enthusiasm gap, their crazy enthusiasm for a product to basically sending in purchase orders. And we've got that formula, I say, you know, pretty nailed down now. We know what we need to do. So unlike earlier rounds, we're using a lot of the money to explore what the right model is, the right product sets, et cetera. We know exactly where our money's going now. And it's going toward building and innovating, but it's going to sales and marketing. And we will rapidly expand our revenue doing that and through strategic partnerships with some industry titans.
Wonderful. Let's talk a little bit, give a couple of minutes to the technology itself. So from the beginning of the company to where you are now, what were some of the major technological hurdles that you crossed over? You know, I know light consistency being as strong at the beginning near the source as far away from the source, controllability. Talk a little bit about the evolution of the technology within.
Sure. Well, if we start with the problems with LEDs, again, a high-tech product and an extremely low-tech industry, there's issues. Even today, 10 years later, the industry solution has the same problems. We are the only one that solved it. Luckily, we were able to patent it, get granted patents. The issues, again, are, I'm sure you have experience buying an LED light bulb or fixture that fails many years before they're promised to fail. You try to dim them down below 15 to 20%, they start flickering. The heat built up in the fixture and the bulb is caused by what's called power conversion electronics, converting high voltage AC, which is in all our buildings, to low voltage DC, which is what LEDs run on. So this freight train of power is being sent through a building for fixtures that use a trickle of watts. It makes no logical sense whatsoever. And the problems that I talked about ensue. So by taking all those electronics out and remoting them, we're able to run speaker wire in commercial and residential, believe it or not. We get rid of all the hard pipe, the conduit, it's called conduit, the MC cable, the Romex, and tons of labor. Grabbing a bundle of speaker wire and running it to a room and wiring it up is quite easy. Running all that heavy copper with junction boxes and all is very difficult. So we have solved all those problems with LEDs. You asked about the challenge of doing that. Well, when you have long runs and you're sending power through it, the voltage gets more dirty, it's called. The fluctuations in current and voltage over a long distance creates a situation where it's hard to manage the voltage the further you go out. So some of our brilliant engineers figured out how to do that, which also in a digital manner, which is unique to us, and being able to manage that voltage so that we can dim down to basically zero with absolutely no flicker all the time. So that is one element. So the dimming issue is patented algorithms. People that see what we do just can't even believe it's possible. And also being able to convert that power in a digital fashion outside of the fixture, that is the most efficient way to manage power in a digital fashion because it doesn't build up heat and there's power losses as a result of that. I can get much more technical, but I doubt that's all that appropriate for this this interview. But the bottom line is we have pioneered lots of intellectual property around a system approach of an LED that solves all these problems. Now we're innovating into the IoT space where sensor technology collects data on human analytics, say in a retail store, and we are perfectly positioned with our power technology to collect that data. So we're becoming what's called a data gateway. And we're able to collect that human analytic data and send it to the consumer, which may be a retailer or Google or Apple or Amazon. All these companies are interested in big data because it converts to very targeted advertising online. So I won't go into it any more than that, but we're pioneering IP in the IoT space, which moves us into the big data business as well.
Wow, that sounds great. When you talk about LED systems having issues that you've solved, I'm assuming then there's been an education problem because people who are thinking about buying LEDs say LED on this box, LED on this box, but they're completely different things.
They're very different. The current LEDs leverage off of the Edison infrastructure, the line voltage infrastructure, and changing the fixture at the end of the line voltage terminal, wherever it may be. Our strategy was let's start from the beginning and install an entirely low voltage system, which has distinct advantages, but the disadvantage was we had 130 years of inertia to overcome. And it's finally, as a result of this show last week, as Eric covered earlier, kind of reached its tipping point. They're recognizing that we're a company that's here to stay, and this is technology that's going to be the future of lighting.
That's wonderful. So right now, then, you're on a $5 million raise?
Yes. That brings us to cash flow positive, gets us a comfortable position in what could be a bidding war through a negotiation, and allows us to keep innovating. We're trying to run very lean. We're trying to begin outsourcing our manufacturing as much as possible because we actually manufacture product. As you know, you've seen our facility, and become a technology innovation company, which we are, but focusing on sales and marketing and using local contract manufacturers so that our products continue to be made in America.
Wonderful. Well, I think this will be the first of a couple of conversations. I appreciate you sharing the origin story with us, and we'll look forward to the next iterations.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.